Hello, this is Mike Harbath with this week's Shoot the Moon podcast, broadcasting live and direct from Revenue Rocket World Headquarters in Bloomington, Minnesota. As you guys know, Revenue Rocket is the premier provider of M&A advisory services and growth strategy services for IT services companies worldwide. With me today are my partners, Matt Lockhart and Ryan Barnett. Welcome, guys.
How's it going, Mike?
It's good. It's good. Today we're going to talk about seller due diligence and what in the heck to expect when you are selling your business and a buyer is looking at doing due diligence on your business, an important phase of all M&A transactions. I think we'll start. Maybe Ryan, I'll turn it over to you to talk about kind of pre-LOI due diligence and kind of what to expect to provide someone who's looking at acquiring your business.
Absolutely. So, just when you go through the process and the emotional decision to sell your company, and you decide to go list your business and get people interested and get the marketing material and have introduction meetings and things are really, really going well, you sign an LOI, everyone's really excited. It turns to a moment of a bit of fear in which due diligence starts. And today what we want to talk, and I've got questions for both Mike and Matt on, you know, how does the seller really get through due diligence? You know, what to expect, the emotional toil that it takes on you, and how you run the business while getting through it, and really what it is, kind of the process of surviving. And unfortunately, due diligence feels just like every portion of your business is getting poked and prodded. And there's ways to get through it that can just help you shine, and there's ways that can actually be really detrimental to the successful close of a business to do. So I want to talk about some pitfalls and what to avoid. So maybe, Mike, you can just help us understand in the grand context, you know, what should a seller expect if you're talking pre-LOI, you know, what should a seller expect for due diligence? In order for someone to put an offer on the table, what kind of due diligence do you think is needed?
Well, it's a great question, Ryan. I think it's super important that, you know, a buyer has transparency to your financials, right? They're going to look at your numbers. And when I say look at your numbers, I mean, you need to be providing access to P&L and balance sheet, probably unadjusted. I mean, I think a smart seller, if you're actually in the market, are going to be working with an advisor such as Revenue Rocket, and they're going to have made adjustments to that P&L have the, you know, EBITDA optimized for review by a buyer. But, you know, let's assume somebody approaches you and, you know, you want to provide your numbers to them. You know, it'd be good to figure out what the heck your ad backs are. And that's where, again, advisors can come into play. But you do need to provide a multi-year view into your financials, P&L and balance sheet. You need to provide a multi-year forecast of what the business is going to do. And that has to align pretty reasonably to your historical performance. Or there's going to be a lot of questions about what we call the hockey stick, right? If you've been growing the business at 5% a year and suddenly you forecast it's going to grow at 25% a year, you need to be able to explain, well, what's going to change post-transaction to suddenly and dramatically increase the forecast. And unless you have a good, you know, discussion and story around that, it's not credible. And your forecast, as well as your numbers, will be seen with a bit of a slant eye or, you know, additional scrutiny when you see that sort of crazy forecast versus historical performance. I think a more conservative forecast that aligns to historical growth year over year is much more appropriate and probably to be expected. Because any buyer that's going to look at your business and be able to add synergies and accelerate growth is going to want to absorb that synergy for themselves, right? They're not going to allow you to take advantage of that in a valuation, because a valuation will take into account your forecast as well as your historical performance. We say that it's ideal to have 5 years P&L and balance sheet in a five-year forecast. And if that's not possible, you need to be able to provide at least 3 years on both sides.
You know, Mike, I I think it's great. You jump right into the numbers, right? But, you know, maybe let's back up and talk about, you know, one of the principles that Mike, you've sort of guided in your 20 years of experience here, that there needs to be three general things in place to find these successful transactions and, you know, marriages of two firms. The financial fit, which is at the end of the day, what is going to make or break a deal on both sides. But then importantly is the strategic fit, obviously, and the importance to the buyer in terms of the seller's capabilities to match that strategic fit, and then the cultural fit, right? And so from a seller's perspective, it's important to think about those three things, right? And think about it in the eyes of the buyer and how you position, how the seller is positioned the firm strategically, right? Being ready to be able to talk about how the seller's capabilities can evolve and you know, in a post-integration that creates an accretive value for the buyer. And then likewise on the cultural side, and most important culturally, is what are the management practices? So, you know, as you appropriately sort of start with the numbers in terms of the readiness, because at the end of the day, if those aren't in place and aren't accurate, then nothing's going to get done. But it's also important, you know, it at the first blush to be thinking about those other fit potentials, don't you think?
Yeah, that's a great point, Matt. And thank you for bringing that up. I think it's also important to point out that, you know, pre-LOI due diligence is not providing everything in the world that a potential buyer might want. So sometimes you get stuck in sort of this death by a thousand cuts sort of world where someone who's looking at doing an acquisition says, boy, can I have a, you know, your top 10 customer breakdown? And then I need this and I need that and I need this and I need that. It really, you know, what's needed is certainly to make sure that the big three line up, you know, the strategic, cultural, and financial fit, make sure they have enough information and accurate information to be able to create a credible offer and valuation. But, you know, things like, you know, your breakdown of your top clients, you know, spend, certainly there's some appropriate questions there around concentration, right? How much of your business is contained in maybe your top three or five customers, but beyond that, details about those customers, details about employees should never be necessarily shared pre-LOI. Blinded information, if any, is appropriate to just further the discussion. But it's a tendency of many buyers, particularly financial buyers, to want to have all kinds of information before the letter of intent, to look for any cracks in your assumptions around EBITDA. And, you know, oftentimes that's just not necessary. And so I think understanding how much of detail to provide and what not to provide before LOI is important. Certainly all of those requests are appropriate, most likely post LOI, once you've agreed to terms, both price and terms on a deal. You know, then we get into a whole different set of level of scrutiny around diligence.
I think one way to think about this as a seller is that, first of all, almost everything that's needed for a buyer to put forth an offer should be contained within the marketing materials that you're putting forward. So it's also assumed that an NDA is in place. There's some sharing. So by the time you have an introduction meeting, and you've had the confidential information memorandum released, that SIM should have enough information in it for a buyer to make at least enough of a decision to put forth an offer. And remember, LOIs and offers are non-binding in nature. So there's there's oftentimes adjustability in the understanding of that, that letter of intent. Another way to think about this is pre-LOI, you're often going to be looking at the business through aggregates and reporting. So you'll be looking at sales as an aggregate or sales broken down by a category. That's different than post-LOI, where things will be looking at in a detail level. So expect heavy reporting in the front, but followed up by, you know, what's the proof to the reporting that came with it? So assuming that an LOI is signed, and everyone's congratulates each other, we put forward an LOI and signed. Mike, there's a big clause in it that says, you know, respective to due diligence being completed. And just help sellers understand, you know, why do buyers want to even conduct due diligence in the first place? Is there something that, do they want to simply prove it? Are they trying to discount the deal? What's the ideal scenario the seller should expect of, you know, why buyers are going through this exercise?
Well, there certainly is a business case to be made for doing an acquisition. We've talked a lot about that, right, in the past, that you got to have a solid business case. It needs to line up the three ways for the seller, just like it does, or for the buyer, just like it does the seller, right, strategically, culturally, financially. And there needs to be an aspect of the deal that's sort of 1 + 1 = 3, right? You got to be able to get somewhere together that you can't get apart. And thus that drives sort of thinking around the acquisition for the buyer. So when you begin to think about, you know, all the different components of due diligence, they want to make sure that the financials are accurate, that essentially what you say you're selling is what you're selling. There's not, you know, cracks in the foundation, that the growth trajectory that you're forecasting is attainable based on what you built so far. And they want to understand sort of the health and wellness of the business and how it relates and integrates into their existing business, right? So if it's a what we oftentimes call sort of an adjacency strategy, which might be a revenue expansion into a different area of the business, you know, how does that business work? And, you know, how could it be adjacent to their core business as an acquirer looking at your business? Or is it more of a, you know, more kind of a line extension is what we'll say is another way to say, you know, is it something that's new for acquirer? Or is it something that's very similar or the same as to what their core business is? And then how does it relate from a key metrics perspective into that business? Is your business more profitable than theirs? And why is that? Or is it less profitable? Or there's areas for optimization? You know, again, how do you get to somewhere together that you can't get apart? Those questions have to get answered beyond the, you know, accuracy of the actual data in the financials. And that's why, you know, people look at, can you transfer the contracts? You know, how should they structure the deal? Is it an asset deal or a stock deal? Are there benefits and reasons for such? And, you know, there's a bunch of questions that have to get answered. And it's frankly, you know, again, not to play the commercial again, but, you know, there's a lot of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of things that need to get negotiated. And frankly, you know, if not hundreds, tens of reasons why buyers do due diligence the way they do, and being able to have an advisor on your side that can help navigate all that certainly will make this process go a lot smoother for you.
A couple of other things I think important to sort of prep for. So you hit financials, and obviously transparency and accuracy and correctness and blah, 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 right? All pretty common sense. However, oftentimes you see sellers who aren't ready to be transparent with an accurate view from a reporting perspective into the financials. So I think that's a, you know, just continuing to highlight that. You brought up customers, right? And having a, being ready to demonstrate a good view into those customers, the depth of the relationship, the history of it, how the seller's firm is providing strategic value to their customers, because buyers are going to want to know that those customers are going to be sticking around, or most of them are going to be sticking around, and or there's cross-sell and growth opportunities for, you know, within those customers. And so, you know, that customer piece is absolutely critical. You brought up the contract, what is the contract status, you know, transferable, the duration of the contract, all of these things. And, you know, you can just go layer by layer into the depth. And that, I think, speaks to Ryan's point that that's post LOI when you're getting into that really depth. And so managing, you know, what is pre-LOI versus post LOI is, you know, a consistent theme here. You know, the other piece that I, you know, think is also important for the seller to be ready for is being able to demonstrate the quality of their team, right? Their people. And how those and how that team is going to be an asset to the buyer's organization. So, you know, which members of the management team are, you know, to be highlighted and prepped as part of the selling process post LOI to be able to demonstrate that. And then just the overall team, you know, within the organization, the selling organization and the strength, you know, lack of attrition rates is really important and the like. So, you know, financials, customers, team, you know, those seem to be pretty common themes.
If I could add something here, the as a seller, you're going to get a big list of an ask. So what we often will see this broken down, expect quite literally hundreds of items to be covered. So there's a big portion of this that you just be prepared that a buyer is going to ask for way more than you may even have. So a lot of times we see a boilerplate due diligence template come across, which has things that are asked for that are not relevant to the deal at all. So the first thing as a seller to think about is what's the priority of that list and how can you get that through that list in a meaningful way that helps the buyer make the right decision in moving forward. And frankly, it gives comfort to the buyer on the assets that they're getting. So when you get the list, work with an advisor to make sure that you prioritize that list. From there, start hacking through that. And just to be able to prioritize that. Mike, is there you know, who typically gets the brunt of the work from a seller when they're going through through a process through due diligence? I mean, what should functional teams like marketing, sales, or finance expect when going through this?
Yeah, that's a great question, Ryan. I mean, certainly finance teams need to be heavily involved. You know, usually owners clearly are the first to be contacted and will be involved with making the strategic decisions on whether to, you know, entertain an option or not. But beyond that, there's, you know, a lot of questions around sort of the strategic, I mean, all the big three, right? You can think about it if it's about strategic sort of alignment, you know, cultural alignment, and cultural alignment oftentimes is outlined as, you know, customer care philosophy, employee care philosophy, and how those align. You know, those are two good proxies for, you know, how do you vet cultural alignment, and then financial alignment. So you can think that certainly leadership will be involved. Now, it's important to note that most sellers want to keep the communication and the distraction associated with this conversation to a minimum. Some want to keep it just to owners. Others will open it up to maybe a financial leader. But generally, that's it. And the lion's share of the gathering and data management and parking that data, you know, typically reside in ownership and financial leadership. And, you know, it is our recommendation that, you know, you keep these actions quiet until they're imminently going to close. And so that certainly adds a lot of complexity when you might lean on your team to, or want to lean on your team to be more involved in order to put the best foot forward to a potential buyer. It creates a conflict as to, you know, who needs to know. I often say that it's a need to know basis, and most members of your staff, frankly, don't need to know. So try to keep it contained to, you know, the ownership and maybe financial leadership. And I say maybe because it depends on how fortified your numbers are and how transparent you are with those financials to be able to provide the data that a potential buyer might need. And I think, you know, certainly you need to bring in probably others as you get past the LOI into more substantive due diligence, because the requests in substantive due diligence are vast, and they're going to want to understand strategic plan and go to market philosophy and sales approach and pipelines and, you know, customer management approaches and, you know, everything you can imagine as they're betting, you know, a business for acquisition. So, you know, you need to be able to provide that information, yet, you know, keep the information inside of the team and on a need to know basis.
And Matt, we recently just signed a deal in which there's pretty extensive due diligence. The seller was just fantastic at providing it. What advice did you give that team to help just keep steady, kind of emotionally steady during this? And it's interesting because the buyer wants to get a deal done, and they see if they, let's say, strategic value there is there, there's cultural fit, and you're really building culture throughout this, but all of a sudden you're still like in a bit of a prove it mentality. The buyer said, you know, trying to look at poking holes and assumptions. Matt, what advice did you give through to our sellers to help them emotionally navigate this approach or this bridge?
Yeah, thanks, Ryan. It's as much of an art as it is a science, right? Because you're talking about for a seller, it's a big deal. Especially for in many of the, you know, many technology organizations, right? IT services organizations are founder led, and they've been driving their company and the value of their company for, you know, decade or decades, right? So there's a piece of them that is tied up as part of the business, right? And so, you know, right out of the gate, you just talk about the emotionality of it, right? And being able to talk about it and advise them that it's going to feel weird. You know, they may feel some seller regret, right? At some points, it's like, oh man, I'm letting go of this thing. And I think that's the first place to start. And you can refer back to that and go, remember, we talked about this, that there's going to be a piece of emotion tied up into it. You know, when the buyer comes in and maybe questions some of the story or the information, and the seller can go, well, wait a second, I'm a good guy, I'm honest, I'm guy, girl, you know, and I've been super transparent. How could you question anything? Well, the buyer's just doing their job, right? And so you can't take it personally. Being emotionally ready is super important. It's really the first step, you know, as a seller to make sure that that's in place. And so being able to refer back to keeping your eye on the prize, keeping your eye on the finish line, and knowing that there will be a bit of ebb and flow, and knowing that there's going to always be a negotiation in place. And so to not take any of those things personal, you know, Mike, you've talked often about the fact that, you know, deals just on a percentage basis, they don't get done unless there's an advisor in place. And you know, our job is to take as much of the emotional baggage, right, on behalf of our clients, and to minimize that for them, just for their well-being. But then also, you know, referring back, Brian, to saying, hey, the seller's got to continue to operate the business, right? And that is absolutely critical, to operate the business as though there wasn't a transaction going on. And, you know, you've got to have a steady hand at the till to be able to do that.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure. I'll weigh in a little bit on the stats on, you know, likelihood to close. I think, you know, it's this process, you've heard us say this before, it is the most unnatural act in business, and it is challenging to get all the work done and to try to manage the distraction vis-a-vis operating the business while you're closing. And certainly having competent assistant advisors around legal, accounting, and deal makers, which, you know, is the role that an M&A advisor plays, certainly can help you, one, get the work done, which there's a ton of work that needs to be done, but also do it in an efficient manner, in one ultimately that is successful. Because the likelihood, if you're missing any one of those three-legged stools of advisors, getting them done, is the likelihood that gets done goes way down. And when you look at statistics, they range anywhere from, you know, you have a 1% probability to get the deal done if you roll your own, to, you know, as high as maybe 40%. But it's certainly low. And I would say that most companies that are thinking about, quote unquote, rolling their own, is the term we use, you know, may include, well, you definitely need to include your lawyer because the deal has to be fortified accordingly and legally binding when you're working through the agreements. But, you know, sometimes people try to do it without a tax advisor or without an M&A advisor. And those are two really critical roles that if you don't have competent advice in either area, you run the risk that, you know, something's going to bite you and the deal's not going to get closed. And I think you want the experience of all of those three constituents of advisors to make sure that if you run into a snag, which you will, there's always some challenge or snag or thing that needs to be negotiated or aligned, that you bring the collective experience of those team members to the table to solve it. Because the likelihood, if they're an experienced M&A lawyer and an experienced tax advisor around M&A and an experienced deal maker, in IT services, they've seen this before, right? They've seen a lot of these challenges and questions that come up before. And they can provide a experience and a context that you can't really get any other way. So just food for thought. Brian, back to you.
Thanks, Mike. And one last thought here before I sum it up. When you work with an advisor, make sure that if there is something of concern, don't just puke up raw data in a report. Work with an advisor to actually analyze the report and come up with data that could be troublesome. So your advisors are there to help and to help you get through sticky situations. And things can be explained or they can be negotiated. And so, however, if you just throw up a report that shows something bad, let's say the customer churn that's unexplained, that can torpedo a deal. So please be careful with some of the data that you're releasing. Make sure that it goes through a second pair of eyes and that it's something that the buyer can understand. So when you think about this and just wrap it up, remember, pre-LOI only give the information that's needed to get to the LOI. Once an LOI, you're going to get a list. Emotionally prepare yourself for getting that list. Prioritize it. But start to work through the functional areas of the business, paying a special attention to financials, contracts, and operational type work. Expect this to be a really tough process, but you'll get through it. At the end of the day, everyone at the table may hate each other just slightly, but that's when you know that deal is just about done, ready to be done. The due diligence is what's there to help a buyer be comfortable with the business, and you'll be working together once the business is sold. So work together towards getting a deal done, and it can be successful for the future. So great, Matt and Mike, really appreciate your thoughts today. And Mike, I'll turn it over for you.
Sounds great, Ryan. Thanks a lot. So with that, as you know, we're going to tie a ribbon on it for this week. Look forward to next week's podcast. So I encourage you to tune in as we continue to explore topics around how to successfully and profitably grow your IT services company and help you get M&A transactions done. With that, take care.